Hello and a big welcome back to Expected Goals, the Brighton Albion podcast. I'm joined once again by Charlie Benny. Charlie, how are you doing?
I'm well, Liam. Just about getting through this period of no football. It doesn't get any easier by the day, but luckily we still have lots to talk about. Football's never a dull subject, so we're here again.
Most definitely. We're going to attempt to fill that void and make life a little bit easier for everyone. We've got a couple, and I say a couple, this is going to be a two-parts podcast. Things get very exciting over here. We've got a two-part recruitment special with a couple of special guests as well. Much like London buses, you wait sort of 13 episodes for a special guest and then two come along at once. So don't say we don't treat you, because we most definitely do. So please do stick around to hear what they have to say. But this week's podcast is looking at sort of being a bit recruitment themed. Got a lot of great response from you all on Twitter as well, so thank you very much for that. Been really active over there, but I suppose everyone's so bored that you probably decide to respond to my tweets now, which is about fair enough. But some sort of great feedback in regards to looking at our signing so far as a Premier League side. To kick us off, Charlie, the question that I asked everyone on Twitter was, who's been your favourite signing for us as a Premier League team? What do you think has been the best value for money signing that we've made? And finally, what area do you think we perhaps need to recruit in a bit further?
My favourite signing, I'll start with that. To be honest, it was a little bit of a tough one. We've made a couple of decent signings. I think the majority of our big successes were in the first season. And often, you know, sometimes it takes a bit of time to get things right when you move up a division. You're dealing with a different level of finances. You're dealing with different kinds of personalities. But credit to our recruitment team, our owners and stuff, that they're clearly very clued in, and it's no problem for them. My favourite signing is Matty Ryan, because I think he's generally been overlooked a little bit since he's come to the club. Like whilst he's played, you know, pretty much every game that he's been available, and as a goalkeeper, there's that extended kind of scrutiny that you get. I think he's been nothing short of fantastic. He did not have a glowing reputation coming from Valencia, having been out on loan. I don't think he was really making a huge name for himself in Europe, and it takes some level of bravery to stand by your convictions and believe that you've found the right person. You've found someone within a good price point that can make a positive impact on your team, and he's been excellent. He's shown people who suggested he might be too small or there was other deficiencies in his game, he's proved them wrong, and I think he's been one of the most important parts of our solid defensive record up until probably maybe this season.
To be fair, I couldn't agree more. To be fair, I think Ryan's been an excellent, first of all, an excellent shot stopper, more so under Hughton, but it's still been excellent, by the way, under Potter. I know he's come under a lot of stick on Twitter. To throw some numbers out there, just to perhaps put people at ease a little bit, in terms of, if you were to look at expected goals conceded, which is specifically for goalkeepers, so the expected goals are the shots on targets that they face, Matty Ryan has prevented an additional 4.7 goals from going in, which is obviously a very good number. That's the eighth best in the league if you rank all the keepers. De Bracco and Gaeta lead the way. To put that into a bit of context, really, with how bad some keepers have been this season, Jordan Pickford's conceded 4.1 goals more than he should have. Kepa with 5.8 more than you should have. So if you think if there was a spectrum and you were to perhaps put Pickford and Kepa at the wrong end of that, Matty Ryan has been as good additionally as they've been as bad. So that really does highlight perhaps his primary role. But I think, and you'll probably agree with me here, Charlie, what I think Ryan perhaps deserves the most credit for is the transition he's shown in his ball-playing ability. Whilst no one doubted his ability to play passes and most importantly play passes under pressure, he's been absolutely fantastic this season and been a real sort of key asset for us in playing out from the back, in trying to build play, showing confidence, composure, willingness, and on top of that as well, he's shown great rates and success in doing things. I believe he still currently holds the record at the moment for most short goal kicks played and things like that. So he really is doing these things in high volume. And bear in mind that last season he was launching a significant number of kicks long. I think he's been absolutely fantastic. What have you made of him with his ball playing ability this season?
Yeah, it's gone from strength to strength. I think it was good before. I think he came to the club with a decent level, which I think you know, really stood out over who he replaced in David Stockdale. I think he was a clear upgrade in that sense. But he's got better and better. We've got fantastic goalkeeping coaching in Ben Roberts, and you can see, especially with Potter's influence now. it's completely uncompromising, and he's not scared to make difficult passes. He's proactive in looking for different kind of measures and styles of distributing the ball. One of my sort of pet peeves with Pickford, maybe he's very overly keen to kind of, he's very demonstrative in the way that he, you know, if he collects a ball, makes a very big show, running to the edge of his box, barely setting himself and launching a side volley, forward, which is intended to be a sort of a defence splitting pass, but more often than not is casually nodded back to the opposition goalkeeper. Whereas Ryan is more measured, he's sensible with what he does, and the things that he does, he does effectively. And just as an additional point, if his, you know, level of ball playing ability wasn't up to scratch, no doubt in my mind that Potter would be looking for a replacement, or indeed may have taken a brave decision to have replaced him within the club. Because at Swansea the season before, I believe that he prioritised heavily being able to play, the goalkeeper being able to play from the back over shot stopping. And I think it's Tremel, maybe? It's the goalkeeper.
Gerhard Tremel, yes, yeah.
The guy that was playing... correct me on that if I'm wrong. I'll have to check. But apparently, their secondary option, much better shot stopper, but never really saw much action, just because of how much Potter preferred the goalkeeper being able to contribute with his feet.
There you go. Just some numbers to back up what we've all been thinking. Ryan's got the fifth lowest percentage of launched passes this season. This is data, by the way, from Football Reference, which is a great free site that StatsBomb use. So a great company, by the way, that they throw all their data out on. Completely free. So in terms of launch passes, ones that he just sends long, so the fifth fewest percentage of passes sent long, and in regards to his completion rate, it's the third best in the league as well, which is pretty good. 52%. Only Edison and Alisson have bettered that, by the way. So, you know, it's not bad company to be in for a goalkeeper who spent two seasons just launching most things. So definitely agree with you there, Charlie. I've been very impressed by him. Some of you on Twitter as well hit a couple of nominations. Amongst Davey Proper, got five of the tweets that responded to me. Another player who's been excellent, not only in terms of his output, but in terms of sort of his stylistic play, aesthetically. When he's really on it, one of our most unplayable players, got the ability to sort of play back to goal, can spin players. Ball manipulation is fantastic. Shown you can use literally every surface of his foot to make a pass, as he showed at Man United away a couple of seasons ago. Perhaps a bit overly criticised in terms of his lack of goal scoring ability. Doesn't score many goals, but then when you compare it to other sort of midfielders in Europe, no central midfielders in Europe really score goals. So he's not like an outlier. He's about middle of the pack in terms of actual goals and assists per 90. So not too bad at all in that respect. A couple of other nominations. Pascal Gross had three. Neil Mopai and Bernardo had a nomination as well. So I think it's fair to say we've had a variety of good signings. And as you said, Charlie, with the strength of our recruitment, I think I can only agree with you, really did seem to come in that 17-18 season, which, although it's perhaps been a bit disappointing, and we might see better come out of the more recent signings. I mean, Neil Mopai, Adam Webster, just to name two, have sort of become mainstays and might go above what some of the other signings did. But it's important to build a strong foundation as well. And it's good and reassuring to see that the likes of Proper, Gross and Ryan, who were all bought in that first window, alongside, of course, the players that we'd bought as championship players when we were in the championship at the time. It's good to see that strong foundation is still there, most definitely. In terms of value for money, then, who would you consider to be perhaps our best pound-for-pound signing?
I think I'll avoid sort of naming Ryan again, although obviously worth a mention, £5 million for a goalkeeper of a really, really good age as well. It's very unusual for goalkeepers to sort of hit their peak at sort of 20, 25, and not necessarily Ryan is at his peak, but he performed really, really well for a young goalkeeper and will continue to produce, hopefully, for a long time now. So it's a really good, really good price for the age and the ability that we've got. I think it's very difficult to look past Pascal. I'm going to avoid sort of free transfers because I think that's sort of it's normally circumstantial.
Cheating. That is, yeah, cheating.
Sort of cheating. Obviously, it's really, really important that you can pick up, you know, good deals, and I maybe contradicting myself slightly, you know, every bargain that you pick up is going to be circumstantial in some way or another, Andone's relegation clause and Pascal Gross with the same. So I think it's difficult to look past Gross, especially for the output in his first season. He was just been absolutely exceptional, just not just in terms of his concrete numbers, but in terms of the chances created, big chances created. Obviously, he is just a set-piece merchant, and unless the ball's on the corner spot, he can't kick the ball straight, as we do know. But I don't think I need to convince you too much to say that Pascal Gross is an unbelievably good value signing.
Most definitely. Around about £100,000 we paid per goal involvement of his, which is an incredible number to show, one, the low fee that we paid for him. And likewise, as you've mentioned, the significant amount of goal involvements that he's had. 27 of them, which is, I believe, joint with Glenn Murray for raw output, which is fantastic numbers. I know he's not everyone's aesthetic type of player, but as you say, no one can dispute the sort of numbers that he puts up. And set pieces have continued to be sort of a key threat of ours. Shane Duffy with 5 headed goals last season, Lewis Duncan, Adam Webster this season, both scoring and setting up goals from set pieces. We really have got, and admittedly, it's more of an old school tactic. I'm not sure why. Some people don't seem to like set pieces. I think personally, they're fantastic. The World Cup for me demonstrated that. As England did the old school thing of scoring loads of set piece goals. I think at the end of the day, any football fan with the right mind will celebrate any goal. And especially when football hopefully soon starts back up again. I don't think we'll care how the goal's going by that point. It'll just be get that ball in the back of the net. Let's get some more points on the board. Definitely Gross has been absolutely fantastic. By the way, both of those signings were named by Andy Naylor in what he called his Magnificent Seven on Twitter for Amex era signings, alongside Bruno, Glenn Murray, Shane Duffy, Anthony Knockhart and Dale Stevens as well. In terms of value for money, I'm going to argue one that I'm not sure why you haven't argued, Charlie, and that would be Steven Alzate, who cost us £99,000 from Orient and so far has looked absolutely quality. Hasn't quite got the statistical backing yet in terms of goal outputs that Gross had, but nonetheless, he's been an exceptional jeweller. He's got one of the highest rates in terms of tackle success and take-ons. Four nutmegs this season, it's the most of any Brighton player. I think, would you agree, Charlotte, it's perhaps fair to argue him as being almost the perfect sort of player for both a manager and a fan, in the sense that he's got the versatility that Potter loves. It's literally archetypal of Potter's tactical flexibility that he wants players and the ability to sort of exist and manifest into different shapes and different attacking systems. And likewise, the fluidity, the freedom, the risk-taking that all comes with the system. That is literally, if you had to sort of describe Steven Alzate's playing style, he does all of that. And on top of that, looks really good with the ball, very aesthetic, sort of glides across the pitch. He looks fantastic.
Yeah, I would agree with that, to be fair. It's sort of tricky because whilst he has looked really, really good, and any young player that you have on your books, even if it didn't come directly from your academy, you really want them to do well. Admittedly, had some injury trouble, some rotational things. So, you know, he's had a good first season, but the fact that no goals, and no, I believe no assists. I might be
proven. No assists, unfortunately. No assists.
Which is, I don't want to say concerning, but it's something that maybe kind of inhibits me from suggesting that he's an unbelievably good value for money signing. Because ultimately, football is pay to play. You know, you need to invest in order to strengthen your team to make sure that you're staying in the big money league, and that of course is the Premier League. And you can't stay in the Premier League with no goals or no assists from any
definitely
player. So ultimately, there's a place for all kinds of players. Some players just don't tend to contribute directly that much, and maybe they're more facilitators. Equally valuable, of course, because it's more about the team's kind of overall performance. I think you're completely spot on about how he's kind of performed aesthetically in terms of the fan enjoyment, glides past players. His duels have been really, really, really good numbers that you've put up earlier today, which got a look at. Some really, really nice stuff coming from him. Defensive duels, I think. Attacking duels, excelling in, not so much defensively. Although saying that he hasn't featured at fullback too frequently anyway, so it might be worth taking that into account when you look at those sort of stats. But again, a really, really good smart signing, and shows the worth in dipping into the lower leagues and the English football pyramid to find talent.
Definitely. Something that I think is vastly underrated, but is becoming definitely more of a prominent tactic within clubs, as we've shown with Webster and Mapai, that you can sort of pinch players from the Championship and lower leagues, and they can definitely turn out to be quality. I think Lazarte probably definitely more one for the future, perhaps a worthy nomination, but as you say, it's quite hard to look past someone who's got your joint most Premier League goal involvements for just £3 million, which is literally pretty much pennies in this sort of market. With all the good stuff taken into consideration, then we've also got to be realistic and perhaps look at the areas we might need to recruit in a little bit more. The general sort of understanding I was getting on Twitter was there being a lot of perhaps dissatisfaction around performance in wide areas in terms of wingers and fullbacks, saying we perhaps need to recruit there more strongly, and also a few shouts as well for the sort of defensive midfielder. I presume someone perhaps more suited to Dale Stevens' sort of play. Because whilst the likes of Bissouma and Proper are fantastic, I definitely think they work better with someone who's perhaps a bit more disciplined to sit a bit deeper, perhaps allowing them that freedom to go forward. Although both are, of course, good players deserving of merit. We don't really have a second sort of player like a Stevens. Admittedly, there are some great players out on loan, the likes of Jason Malumbi, Max Sanders, of course, Tudor Baluta as well. So there's real strength and depth in the academy. So whether we'd need to directly recruit, I'm not sure. But it, again, might be a little bit soon for those to make the jump up through. Charlie, what's your take on perhaps where we might need some strength?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I think Stevens really offers a lot when he does play. Maybe hasn't been as much of a mainstay this year. Just part of Potter's rotational kind of style. He hasn't been playing game in, game out, as he has done in previous seasons. The worry is, of course, if you replace him, you maybe try and upgrade on that position, then you're blocking the path to the first team for some of the younger players coming in. Jason Malumbi's had a really good season for Millwall. We covered him in a previous loan special. Well worth a listen. Cheeky plug there, if you haven't heard it already. He's had a decent season for Millwall, but for me, from what I've seen, I don't think he could quite cut it perhaps tactically in the Premier League next season. I think he's going to need another year out on loan. A really, really talented youngster, and has shown that from a really, really young age as well. Since he was sort of 17, he's been a standout player in our academy and has always looked the part. But I think there's no need to rush him in. He had his difficult injury. He hasn't played all that much football. You know, been desperate to get him out and to play consistently. And he has done that and he's done well, but I think we need to be sensible with that. I don't necessarily think we need to upgrade in that position, though. Again, as I said, I don't think that there's any reason to oust Stevens if he's doing a decent job. I think Alzate can play that slightly deeper role. The composure there is good. The only issue is he doesn't have the kind of physicality and enforcer kind of style that Stevens has, which Malumbi could bring, but I think tactically and perhaps also technically as well, he might get shown up a little bit as a single sitting midfielder. Davey Proper can operate in that role. Tudor Baluta hasn't really seen too much action this year, so I guess the jury's out on that one.
Believe it's by injury, actually, for Baluta, that's all. I think he's had a bit of an injury. That's why his minutes have been limited.
Interesting. Well, I guess I can see why people are interested in upgrading in that position, but for me, it's not a massive priority, or at the very least, I feel like if you're going to upgrade in that position, it's either got to be a very opportunistic situation where you see someone for really, really good value who will, you know, who's likely to improve your team, or, you know, you have to find exactly the right. We were interested in Sander Berg, I believe, for a period of time.
We were, yes, which is sad.
But to be honest, credit to Sheffield United's players, who've performed out their skin this season. When he's come in, he has not looked brilliant, to be fair. I think he's been outshone by Lundstrom and Fleck and Norwood. Mm. I think, to be honest, in the games that I've seen him, he did not look the wondrous prospect that he's touted to be. I'm sure there's a talented player in there somewhere for sure, but to be honest, and there's no shame in looking somewhat out of place coming to a new country and a difficult league, especially considering how well Sheffield United's midfielders have performed.
I think so. I think it's hard to cast too much of a judgment. It is early days in his time there. Still quite a young player as well, I believe. He's not particularly old. He might still be under 23. So likewise, when we haven't been as critical of certain newspapers this season, although we are, of course, gutted to miss out, I think one of the points I tried to make to people at the time was, is a defensive midfielder exactly what we need right now? In the sense that if we were bringing in Burge, I think a player of his status and where he was already playing would warrant perhaps a starting place, which we wouldn't have been able to offer him without getting rid of Stevens, who, as Charlie has said, and I can only echo in terms of those thoughts, I still think Stevens is a quality player who is statistically very, very good as well. Averages a very good amount of long passes per game, 5.31, with 63% accuracy, which compared to Bissouma and Proper, it is the highest for both of those metrics. So although he's very often criticised of playing boring football in terms of just sort of being a ball circulator with these backwards and sideways passes that he loves so much, I think he showed from Mapai's goal against Wolves that he has also got that ability to sort of hit that long ball in behind, that he can break down teams. And I think there's also a lot of merit as well in a player having the ability to play a lot of passes a game. In a high position side, you do need players who are going to have the psychological capabilities for 90 minutes to, you know, stay focused, stay alert, constantly going to see that sort of the right passing lanes, and to get into those positions to receive and then make passes. One tiny more thing to cover, Charlie. There are a few people have been sort of discussing fullbacks as well, and the wingers, and sort of saying that they think we're perhaps a bit limited in those areas, either in terms of numbers or in terms of ability. The one thing that I was considering was, given that this season we've sort of played, if it was a back four with sort of a narrow midfield, or of course sort of a 3-4-3 with sort of false wingers, if you like, in terms of Trossard being a bit inverted, or Gross or Moyes on perhaps operating in more of sort of the half space region. I don't think, in terms of depth wise, we need more in the fullback areas. We've got Bernardo and Byrne, who can both play sort of left back. Alzate, Montoya, the Greyhound as well, Ezequiel Schelotto. I think there's plenty of depth in there, and their output isn't too bad either. By the way, Montoya averages one of the highest crossing accuracies in the team. 42% of crosses are accurate from him, which is the best of any fullback that we've got, apart from March, who also can sort of play that left wing back role. So I think it's really sort of quite hard to be critical of the fullbacks this season. I think what we're sort of going into is having lost sort of that numerical advantage in wide areas, having gone from sort of the left mid and left back that we had in the 4-5-1, 4-3-3, 4-2-2 that Hughton used to play, is that we've just got limited numbers in those areas now. So we're perhaps more reliant on individuals, more trying to play through central zones with the likes of Moy and Gross. Things are pretty just a bit more fluid now as well, that we're not looking at certain individuals and going, you're going to create in these specific scenarios. It's going to be a case of, look, we've got tactical ways that we're going to work. We've got patterns that we're going to use. We've got these individuals who can also work in wide areas. I haven't thought the fullbacks have been particularly bad this season. I think they've been quite good. What have you made of our fullbacks, Charlie?
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think Dan Byrne pushed out there, you know, made a point of saying that I'm not satisfied with seeing him out there just because that's not where he excels. I think the left side of defence is, you know, centre-back, is he shows his quality far more. You know, there is some useful elements to having him being able to push up the field, win flick-ons towards the halfway line. Matty Ryan's distribution coming up again, it has been an important tool at times, but I really don't think that he's well suited to that particular position. In my opinion, he's done a good job when he's been there, no fault to him whatsoever, but for me, I'd prefer to see a more orthodox left back. Bernardo not really featured too much, some injury problems again, so could suggest that we might want to look at upgrading at left back. At right back, we've got Lamptey, who's just come in. Again, you know, there's nothing to tell there, really. Really good prospect and a good deal. We can say that we haven't overspent. I think he looks like a bit of a steal, to be honest. But we'll obviously have to wait and see if he can adapt to playing first team Premier League football regularly. On Montoya, I'm still pretty salty about that, because Montoya, as you say, his chance creation, his crossing accuracy is actually quite exemplary. Some elements of defensive frailty, although he has improved over the last last few months, to be fair. I think, you know, hasn't featured too much as of late. Obviously, the season's been suspended for a while, so it kind of feels like we're talking about, you know, the season prior. It's quite an aloof sort of thing.
Yes,
but, I really, really did think he was in my fantasy football team from the start of the season. I watched him in pre-season playing so high with the 3-4-3 sort of formation, the amount of chances created, and his accuracy, his good crossing ability. And I just thought he's under the radar. He's going to rein him in. No assists this season. I cannot believe
it. I thought he's got one Didn't he get one for Trossard against Norwich? Or did FPL not count it? Definitely put in the cross, but I know some a couple of stats providers have given it to him. But I believe there was a slight deflection.
Stingy. I don't know if it was... I mean, they might have counted it. But at the very least, he doesn't score a goal. And I know that's a bit of an ask. But he has a decent numbers for touches in the box, I think. A few couple of shots. Obviously, he had that instance at Palace where he was upon shooting, which maybe he would have done better with that effort if he hadn't been kicked. And if they had given the penalty, which they certainly should have, he would have at least gotten assisted. Morpay had tucked it home. So, as you can probably tell, still not particularly happy.
You don't sound it. It's okay. You've hit it pretty well.
I think the numbers suggest that he's doing the right things. And I like to give players the benefit of the doubt with regards to that. It is frustrating when maybe things aren't materialising in the way that you want. Obviously, goals win games, clean sheets are, you know, those kind of tangible things are important. But, you know, players do their best to, you know, the defensive actions and attacking actions that we can monitor do indicate the kind of job that they're doing. And I think Montoya, when he plays, does offer a decent deal. Put it this way, I'm not uncomfortable when I see him on the team sheet. I don't mind him, quite like him.
I agree with you most entirely on that. He's one of the only players that we've got this season to average over a chance created per 90, by the way. Gross Trossard and Moyes, you'd expect, sort of the three. Averaging just over one.
Really?
Him, wow. Alireza Yohanbash, admittedly, who has 282 minutes, so that is possibly skewed by a low minutes played. And Solly March as well is a frequent in terms of the amount of actions he does. Much less successful, though. He averages 4.71 crosses per 90, but just 1 in 4 accurate. So he's only really putting in, I dare say, one quality ball, because if this Y Scouts sort of metrics are measured on what I think they're on, which is usually first contact on a cross, as we well know, you can put in a really good ball, as I think Trossard showed, or McAllister, I can't remember who it was, against Wolves. You can put in a really good ball, or into a dangerous area at least, and not have any contact on it. But in terms of actual crosses to teammates, March puts in a lot of crosses, just not overly successful. Whereas Montoya is lower, about 2 or 3 crosses per 90, but with a much higher accuracy. So it's a big trade-off. It's a case of, do you want a player who will do something a lot, sort of a high-frequency, low-output player, or a low-frequency, high-output player? It's always a difficult trade-off. Neither are a perfect scenario. But I agree with you, Charlie. He doesn't make me uncomfortable at all. I think a valuable tool, and it's shown in the fact, again, he's one of those players that is carried over from Houghton to Potter. So if both saw something in him and continue to use him frequently, I think that says more about him than sort of any conclusion that we can reach. But before we move on to sort of the interview element with Kieran Maguire, just before sort of me and Charlie wrap up, any final things, Charlie, to say from an initial recruitment standpoint?
I'd say that I think overall, as a general review, I think our recruitment has been pretty good. I think the instances of... I think it's quite a volatile market. And I'll use, for example, Joelinton from Newcastle as an example of kind of when things go wrong. It's £30 million, £40 million maybe, actually. Either way, big money for a striker who scored, you know, barely any goals all season. There's not
I think it's one.
I didn't want to say one because I think it is one.
It's one, it's Spurs,
And Newcastle as a team have shown absolutely no attacking threat. They rank very, very lowly for chances created. But, you know, they're not
bottom.
They've not, you know, not had a good season in terms of creating attacking like momentum. But maybe that's not all his fault. Maybe that obviously that's his low numbers are a result of the rest of the team, or maybe he is also contributing heavily to that. Point being is, you can make big mistakes when it comes to recruitment. It's a really difficult process. And frankly, I can't think, apart from Yohanbash, who, just as an aside, whilst he hasn't produced the sheer numbers that we would have liked, his attitude and his contribution on pitch in terms of his running, his willingness, his desire to make things happen, I don't think you can fault that. And he has not been a poor addition to the squad in any way. And whilst we've certainly overpaid for him, I don't think it's something that you can be too hung up on, to be honest. So in summary, good recruitment, B+ for our recruitment, I rate it.
I think that's a very fair judgment. I think our recruitment has been better than it has been bad. Of course, the majority of players, you picked up a fair few bargains in there as well. I think the biggest testament that we can give it is the fact that there's players that we bought before the Championship, there's players that we bought before we kicked a ball in the Premier League that are still key players for us now. We haven't had to have massive overhauls, and we've not got one of the oldest squads in the league either. So it's not like in sort of a season or two's time we're going to be saying, look, we've suddenly got a load of players that aren't going to cut it anymore, and we're going to need to have a massive overhaul. So I think we're in a very good place from sort of a long-term recruitment perspective. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see, should there perhaps be an additional window, which I don't think there should be, and I doubt there will be, but depending on what the state of play is in regards to the rest of the season, it might be interesting to see what sort of deals are done and see sort of how the club goes from there. But anything else from you, Charlie?
Just that I've noticed that the club have uploaded a catch-up sort of phone Skype interview with Uwe Hoenemaa and Inigo Calderon. So if you are missing football as much as I am, probably I haven't actually watched it yet, but probably worth a watch. So I direct everybody to the official Fight Live Albion YouTube and have a bit of Caldy love. I can't say no to that.
Definitely, I agree with that. But before you do go and watch that, please do stick around because you've got a 40-minute lovely chat now. Yeah, not straight away. Don't go just yet. We're fortunate enough to have a nice 40-minute chat with Kieran Maguire, who, if you don't know who he is, one, I don't know how you don't know, and two, you will very soon know who he is. So please do keep listening to the end of the pod for a fantastic chat with him about all things football finance related. But that's all from me and Charlie for now, and we will see you for part two. I'm delighted now to welcome Kieran Maguire onto the podcast. Kieran, pleasure to have you on. Would you be able to introduce yourself just for anyone that doesn't somehow know who you are?
My name's Kieran. I'm a Brighton fan, and I teach at university, a bit of football and a bit of finance. That's my background. I do a podcast with comedian Kevin Day, who's a Palace fan, but he's an extremely talented bloke as well, and we just moan like two old blokes like to moan about the state of the world today and how money has an influence on the game that we love so much.
Fantastic. You've got a book out now as well. And I do believe currently you're giving a lot of those proceeds to charity in this current pandemic. So I think there's no better time if anyone wanted to go and grab your book. We'll put a link to it on the podcast as well. So please do go and buy it. Kieran's a fantastic financial expert, posts a lot of great stuff on Twitter as well. So please do give him a follow. And we now have the pleasure of sort of picking Kieran's brains for a period of time. So one of the biggest questions that me and Charlie were sort of hypothesising was, what extent really does money sort of change from being a Championship side to a Premier League side? What, as a club, as Brighton of Albion, what have we sort of experienced in terms of change? How big is that change?
It's unprecedented. If you go back to when we were at Withdean in 2011, with the Albion left Withdean, and that year they generated income of £7 million. Now, last season, we generated income of £143 million. So in less than a decade, the Albion had grown by a factor of 20.
Wow.
Which is, you know, in the history of the club. And I am such a nerd that I do have Albion's figures going back to when it's formed. Yeah, and there's never been such a sea change in terms of the income generated by the club. Clearly, there was a big step up when we moved from Withdean to Falmer. But the move from the Championship to the Premier League just blew that out of the water.
That is quite seismic, I do have to say. So in building off of that, what sort of budget we work with now as a Premier League side, and how does it compare perhaps to other relegation rivals?
Well, last season, our budget was £101 million. That was the total wage bill. That's competitive by Premier League standards. If we are, you know, who are our peer group? Wolves spent 92, Watford 84, Bournemouth 111. So we're a bit behind them. We're a bit behind Southampton, but all the same, you know, we're in that group, and we're a wee bit behind Palace as well. But Palace have supposed to have published their accounts, but for some reason they've not got round to doing it, even though the deadline is today. Which is disappointing. But I think they've got very slow internet connections. I think they're still on 56k.
I was going to say, yeah, they're probably still a bit behind times in Selhurst and the surrounding areas. But that's interesting to see them with, obviously, a lot of people talk about Bournemouth, for example, when they came up, obviously, that their sort of their wonderful campaign when Howe came back to manage them, sort of regarded as a plucky side when they came up, and almost a bit David Villa at a small little club coming up, and just showing how quickly teams can sort of build and create sort of an infrastructure, as you're saying, in terms of your budgets are, you know, absolutely skyrocketing each year. So a big part we were looking at in terms of recruitment was obviously you get two transfer windows. The summer is obviously a longer one where you've got a greater amount of time with which you can make signings, do a lot of your recruitment, and you've obviously not got any games going on at that time. The biggest one is probably the January window. As I'm sure you're aware, every single January window since we've been Premier League side, it's felt like we had the same topic of discussion for pretty much a month of, we need a striker. Are we signing a striker? Amongst other things as well. And people have been particularly disgruntled about the lack of January activity, particularly in this most recent window. Do you happen to know from a financial perspective if January signings appear to be as worth it as summer ones? So do you sort of pay inflated fees in January? How does it seem to sort of work out from a finance perspective?
I think there is a desperation element. I think Tony Bloom has gone on record on many an occasion saying that he's not a fan of the January window for a variety of reasons. The clubs that tend to buy in January are ones who are a bit more desperate, so therefore you pay over the odds. If you think about our last January signing of consequence, that was Jurgen Lacadia, and you know that really didn't work out, did it, in terms of being a successful striker. I mean, this season we do have Alexis McAllister. And I think it was just a real shame that we've not been given an opportunity to see him play as a result of the pandemic. I was at Wolves and I saw him make his debut there. And even in the 10 or 15 minutes he was on the pitch, he clearly looked like he was going to make a positive impact on the rest of the season. In terms of being able to sign a striker who's going to be successful for the second half of the season, the trouble is, you know, what do the Albion have to offer that Bournemouth can't, that Watford can't, and so on? Because all of those clubs are offering, paying broadly the same amount of wages. So you'd either have to go and put together a package which was perhaps overvaluing the player, or you just have to make do with what you've got.
Fantastic. That's really, really interesting, perhaps, to see that a lot of people talk about, oh, the Premier League on its own is the biggest pulling power. I remember sort of Leandro Trossard was speaking about Graham Potter being a massive massive weight in sort of his move here, and other players have said, oh, the opportunity to play in the Premier League is something that no player feels they can pass up in their career. So when you then say with the competition, another club saying, look, as soon as you get competition within the league, it can be very perhaps difficult then to perhaps draw that interest, which perhaps might contribute. I don't believe we've actually made, with the exception of Tariq Lamptey from Chelsea, I don't think we've made a signing from within the Premier League in terms of an over 23 level. But in terms of signings themselves, can you sort of tell us, give us an insight into what goes into a signing financially? What does it entail?
Well, first of all, there has to be connection between the two clubs, and an offer will be made, and that offer will then be considered, perhaps rejected, and then reconsidered. And it's like a bit like an auction. The selling club has a value they have in mind. They're also aware just how desperate the buying club is. And if it is a club in the bottom six of the Premier League, if I was a selling club, I would hold on and hold on and hold on. Now, you know, the Albion's analytical division is pretty sophisticated, and they won't just be looking at one player. They'll be looking at two, three or four players for a particular position at any one time. But they'll also be aware that the player might be, player might be settled where he presently is. And you have to ask, what are the benefits to a player coming to a different country to sign for a team in the bottom six of a division who could therefore potentially be relegated, and he might be aware that there could be significant relegation clauses put into the contract. It's actually very difficult to incentivize a player who's going to get you. And what are we realistically looking for from a January signing? We're looking for somebody who's going to get 7 or 8 goals in half a season. And those players are really expensive. We've seen with Neil Mopay, who I think has played very well for the Albion. He cost us, what, between 15 to 20 million. And we've had a reasonable return. If you're going to increase that return in terms of goals, then you're going to have to add another £10 million onto the asking price. And then perhaps you're going to have to pay a premium on top of that because people know that you're desperate. So all of a sudden, a player who might be going for, say, 15 to 18 million ends up costing you 24 or 25. And you aren't able to go and put a relegation clause into his contract because his agent is in a strong negotiating position, knowing that as a bottom six team, and ultimately that's what the Albion realistically are at that present moment in their Premier League lifespan. If I was an agent, I wouldn't be too keen to sell my clients' rights away too cheaply. And I think we saw that with West Ham. Was it Jared Bowen they signed from?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Bowen contract nearly failed because the agent simply said every time West Ham went to Bowen's agent and says, well, yeah, we're prepared to give him a decent pay packet. If we go down, we're going to knock that in half. And the agent said no. And then West Ham eventually caved in.
It's that simple. Yeah, it really is.
It's who blinks first. And and what we're dealing with is things such as game theory. Somebody like Tony Bloom would be absolutely fantastic to have in that environment, given the nature of what he does. And my understanding from talking to people in the industry is that Paul Barber is also seen as an excellent negotiator because, he's very, very straight. And he doesn't mess people around. And I think we do have some positives at the club. We are known as one of those teams that won't mess players around and tend to come with a fairly straight offer and won't try to get things on the cheap.
Now, that point about blinking first or not blinking first is really interesting. Is that something you think that we've perhaps shown in terms of when you look at recruitment and you almost look at reverse recruitment in terms of not selling players can be just as important or more important perhaps than actually buying players sometimes? We've obviously in recent years had Lewis Dunk have significant interest in the Championship from Fulham, and since we've been promoted, every sort of window it sort of seemed to have him linked to numerous other outfits, and of course Dale Stevens as well was linked to Burnley for a strong period of time. Do you think that we've been particularly good then at that not blinking first in terms of holding on to players?
Yes, and that paid off. Effectively, what the club did was, and anybody, I was at both Middlesbrough and Sheffield Wednesday away that season when we drew with Borough. The Dale Stevens sending off, then 4 days later going to Hillsborough and having four players get injured within the first hour, simply because they'd put so much into the previous match. They weren't match fit. They were emotionally and physically drained. And I think what the club did, and this is where I think its reputation as being a very fair club comes into the fore and acts as a positive. The club had effectively said to some of the senior players, we want you to give it one more year, and if it doesn't work out in 12 months, you can go with our blessing. And Dale Stevens initially wasn't particularly happy with it, but I think it's a testament to his professionalism that he got down. Lewis Dunk was swayed. I'm aware of what Fulham offered. The Albion did give him a contract extension, and when you hear this word contract extension, that's another word for pay rise. And the club, the player gets an extra X thousand pounds a week, and the club gets the player's the player's commitment for another 12 months. So the amount that the Albion were offering Lewis Dunk was not as much as Fulham were prepared to offer. But I think he still felt he was being valued by the club. He was effectively, as a local lad, he felt some loyalty, and his family are all Albion fans. And all of these things counted towards that the Albion historically have treated players well. And that's appreciated in the dressing room. And on the back of that, we were able to hold on to both Lewis and Dale for that further 12 months. And they both been told, yeah, just give us a year because we think we're practically there. We just need a couple of extra pieces into the jigsaw. And of course, Glenn came back and that made a huge difference as well. And we were promoted. So I do think, and I'm not saying this because I am an Albion fan, I'm fortunate enough to sort of to listen to people in the industry quite often. And the one thing that I constantly hear is that everybody's very impressed with the way that the Albion conduct themselves. And I think that's also been reflected in what's happened since the pandemic has taken over our lives over the course of the first few, the first few weeks. Who was the first club to commit to paying the part-time staff? It was the Albion. Who was the first club to in the Premier League to make a commitment to give tickets to NHS staff? It was the Albion. And that all comes down from the very top. And I know that Paul Barber, for some reason, he's not popular with an element of the Albion fans. But if when I talk to people who are else in the game, they think he's one of the best chief executives in the country. And also, he works extremely well with Tony.
A perfect combination then. No, I definitely think that is all absolutely fantastic to hear our club being so well received. Definitely reflects well on us and the individuals, as you said, as well. Going off on a slight tangent here then, we sort of alluded to the differences between sort of signing players from European leagues and sort of the difficulties you can get. What can you tell us about the differences in terms of finances and signing players from perhaps within the English Football League compared to going out as we have done in sort of the German leagues, the Dutch leagues, Belgian leagues, etc.? What sort of differences are there?
Well, I think there's a difference when we're looking to recruit. There's a financial issue, and then there's a cultural issue as well. And I think that if you take a look at what the Albion have done, is that they've done their homework in terms of attracting a player from the Championship. Clearly, there is a wage advantage, and I think that's the approach that the Albion have undertaken. Neil Mopay from Brentford, Adam Webster from Bristol City. Yeah, we've been able to offer them lucrative contracts compared to what they were on at their original clubs. But also, those players will have been scouted many, many times with a view to being on the list. And Neil Mopay wasn't the only striker that the Albion were looking at last summer. Similarly with Adam Webster in terms of being a centre-half. But the advantage of being able to recruit from the Championship is that you simply have more access to those players in terms of being able to observe them in action. There's a slightly greater risk with the overseas players because there is a cultural fit. You know, when you come to a new country, the player may have a partner who feels isolated and things of this nature. So it makes it slightly more difficult. Again, I think sort of it's a testament, and this isn't just the Albion. This is what many clubs are now doing. They're sort of looking at the emotional intelligence aspect of a signing. You know, and is the player is he in a long-term relationship? Are there children involved? Well, how much disruption will this involve? If the player is coming from Spain, do we have somebody on the staff who's already speaking Spanish? If he's coming from Germany, does he already speak German? How good is his English? All of these things, I think, are taken into consideration in terms of the recruitment process. The wages the Albion are able to offer, the Albion are the Deloitte top 30 clubs were published. My understanding from, again, having a quiet word with one or two people, is the Albion were just outside that top 30.
Wow.
Now, we're talking Brighton Hove Albion. Yeah, we've both been supporting them a long time. We can remember with Dean, we can remember Gillingham. And for Brighton Hove Albion to be, I think, the 32nd biggest football club in the world, that means is that if we are trying to recruit players from Belgium, from the Bundesliga, outside of the clubs that qualify for the Champions League, actually we're in a fairly strong negotiating position. You think of a player such as Davy Proper, he came from a very good team in the Netherlands, but we were able to offer a long-term package, which has clearly been extended recently as well, to make it lucrative. And I think they they don't have a particularly big band. So you know, if you go to some clubs, and I'm not having a dig here at Palace, but you know, Palace have got four players who are on over $100,000 a week each, and they've got a lot of players who are on substantially less. And if that star player isn't performing, that does cause issues at times. Mm. Whereas my understanding about the Albion is they keep it to a relatively relatively straight pay structure. There's no huge superstars in terms of somebody being on twice as much money as the other regulars in the first team. And that's good for cohesiveness. That's good for the culture within the dressing room. And if you are, you know, if it is 0-0 in the 89th minute and somebody's coming flying into your box, you know that everybody will lay down their life for each other. And that's one of the things I do notice, that whilst the results have been poor recently, or not as good as we'd liked, with the exception of Bournemouth away, I can't think of a really dreadful performance for 90 minutes.
I definitely agree with you. I don't even think we were by all means terrible at Bournemouth. I think it was a case of, and it feels like a stuck record this season, and the performance stats were backed up of poor finishing, starting the game really well, controlling the game in many aspects. I think, as you mentioned about psychologically for players, in terms of how these signings might affect them, and I think that's really important, is in a game as well, if you're dominating a game for 30, 40 minutes and you then go and concede, that must psychologically have real detrimental impact compared to perhaps, because I mean, we've turned games around when we've conceded early on, but when you do dominate for a period of time and you don't score, I think that must really psychologically impact a player. And you did mention a bit as well about sort of the psychological traits that a player might have. So like even things like cultural differences. Do you think you'd perhaps almost pay more if a player's got those sort of traits already in their locker? Like people were saying about Jahan Bash had a good understanding of English before he came. The same with McAllister, speaks English quite well. Could this skyrocket players' fees even more?
I don't think it would skyrocket, but I think if you've got two players of a similar skill level, and you know they will have analysed all of the metrics of the players. The Albion are deep into the analytical side of things. Then, if you're making a choice as to which one would be our preferred choice, somebody who's more familiar with the language, somebody who's more familiar with the Premier League as a product, I think would get the advantage there, because it's one less thing to worry about. And whenever you're recruiting somebody, when I recruit at university, I keep it simple. You know, do I like you? Do I trust you? Can you do the job? I just ask myself three questions. I think it's far more complex when you're looking at an elite athlete. But once they've done the statistical analysis of a player, then they will have done their homework in terms of the nature of the player himself. You know, we all know that Brighton as a city has a lot of distractions, and you want to make sure that you recruit a player who's not going to be turned by those distractions.
Most definitely. Do you think that perhaps players might be impacted psychologically by the sort of additional premiums that are paid for them, in terms of if they come off the back of a really, really good season like Jahan Bash did? Of course, we were linked to them for, I think it was around £3 million in the Championship. He then, of course, moved within the Eredivisie, won the Golden Boot, scoring a hat-trick on the final day, and then obviously came at an inflated fee from what we would have paid a few years back. Do you think they can, you know, be influenced players psychologically by going to a club and knowing that they've been paid a lot of money for, and perhaps feeling a big sense of pressure?
Yeah, I think if you come in as a club's record signing, that can crush one or two players. It can be an intimidating, because you are aware that there's a huge level of expectation, and that certainly was the case with Ali Jahan Bash. I work with Kevin Day on the podcast, and he was telling me they felt that as far as Benteke is concerned, Benteke is a decent player who just hasn't really been able to live up to the fact that he's Palace's record signing. Whereas who's the lad they signed from Swansea who scored against us?
Jordan Ayew.
Yeah. Well, Ayew was signed for £2 million, and you know, as far as the Palace fans are concerned, he's doing a great job, because
he's got 8 goals this season. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what, one more than Neil Mopay.
There'll be level, in fact, actually. There'll be level after he scored at Sheffield United. Both got 8 for the season.
Yeah, yeah.
So Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, I think the reaction of Albion fans to Neil, and I think I think Neil's a fantastic player. I think he works his socks off. He's very much a team player as well. But he came in as our big striker, our big signing, and that does put additional pressure on you. Whereas the signing of IU, he was seen as a squad player, and he was always a decent player when he was at Swansea. So I think, to be fair to Palace, and whilst we hate saying anything positive, it was really smart recruitment by them.
Definitely. Building on that, then, having looked at sort of a few numbers in terms of fees paid for players and sort of minutes played, it does seem to sort of align that the more we seem to spend on a player, with this season it's a bit more of an exception, sort of the less minutes that they seem to have. So our sort of key players that we've signed as a Premier League club, when you look at the proper Ryan, gross to an extent within that, they were sort of the lower fees that we've paid in terms of players. Izquierdo, of course, would expect be more of a regular had he not have had glass breadstick legs for the past sort of 3 years, and was, of course, a key player in the first season. But the same with Johan Bash, with Lokadia, these players that we did pay inflated fees for, that are now perhaps on the fringes, and Lokadia, for all intents and purposes, looks almost as if he's sort of been outcast. The same with Florian Andone, again, someone that we were almost going to pay. I think you'll probably know the exact fee, but I believe it was between 15 and 20 mil. And we then signed him due to what I believe was a relegation release clause, which meant we got him a cut price. And of course, has now been outcast as well to Turkey. So do you think that can be a real thing that happens within clubs, if some of your best signings can be the ones you pay less money for?
Yes. Yeah. There's always an element of luck. I mean, you're never quite sure what a player's true worth is. And sometimes the bargains do pay off hugely. You think about Anthony Knockaert. You know, he was effectively, I wouldn't say he was kicked out of Leicester, but it was quite clear that his face didn't fit anymore at Leicester. You know, the year when they didn't go up, and he didn't make the impact that he was hoping for. So he went to Belgium, he went to Liège, and then we picked him up for what, £2.5 million,
something like that. It was very cheap.
And nobody argued as well. He was the best player in the Championship in the year that we were promoting, and he was rightfully given the Championship Player of the Year award. So fees and success aren't always aligned. Everybody's looking for a bargain. Yeah, you know, I'm old enough to remember Peter Ward signing for the Albion. I'm old enough to remember Gary Hart signing for the Albion for, you know, ridiculous fees at the time, even by the standards of the division that we're in. And you know, Peter Ward was incredible. And I think one of the great sadnesses is that Albion fans don't realise just how good he was, simply because he joined us as in the third division, and you know, we might have been on television once or twice a year. But it was just staggering to watch at the time, and that was a signing made for £4,000. If you do your homework, you can find bargains still. I mean, Jamie Vardy is a prime example, as is Glenn Murray.
Definitely. Another bargain as well, it's looking like it's going to be one. Steven Alzate, who cost us, I believe, according to Transfer Market, was £99,000. Looking like he's going to be an incredible player, someone that we'll probably do well to keep hold of. But we appear to be trying our hand at this buy-and-sell tactic. Now, the way that I see it as a fan is, in the way that football's evolving in terms of need to compete with other clubs, of course, the more money that you can have is always going to be beneficial in terms of, as you've said, trying to attract players and approaching other clubs as well. Do you think buying to sell can perhaps be a financially viable tactic? If teams shown they can work, of course, we've got Percy Tau, who's still out on loan. I was at Arsenal away last season, where in the away, and we spent a significant portion of the time singing his name, and he's someone who's never yet worn a Brighton shirt. And Alexis McAllister as well, prior to his loan, of course, being terminated at Boca, was looking like someone who might have been sort of an asset that was purchased for the value that they might have in their potential. Can we use that as a tactic?
Yes. I mean, I think the club has, it's the third or fourth highest number of players out on loan in the Premier League. And there is sort of a quasi-investment division there. Yeah, if you look at some of the players that we've sold for decent fees. You know, I think I can't even remember his name because I don't think he ever played for us. But I think we had a Romanian lad that we sold for around about £4 million. I think he's the second biggest sale in the club's history. And it was a case of the recruitment team identifying talent, bringing them into the under 23 environment, then letting them go out on loan. They make a positive impression when they're out on loan, and then either the host team, or rather the team that the player has gone to, or another team in that division is impressed and will come in and make a fee. If you think about Lamptey, who we've signed from Chelsea for £3 million, that's a player who made one Premier League appearance
off the bench as well.
That's right. Sam Johnson at West Brom, he was on the Manchester United bench, and United managed to sell him for around about 8 to 10 million to West Brom. So I think clubs are cottoning on that the recruitment market is actually a means of generating money for clubs, and that does make a lot of sense, because if you actually look at the fundamentals of football, we've got match day income, which can't go any higher at the Amex. You know, I know they're planning on bringing in a few more seats, but there's relatively no room to go upwards there. In terms of the commercial income, we're Brighton Hove Albion. We're not Manchester United. So I think the deal that they've signed with American Express, and again, this is part of the Albion's sort of culture of not wanting to get involved with too many industries which are sort of sin industries, and therefore American Express quite like that. We're seen as quite a wholesome club, quite a family club. But even so, we have to be realistic. Our commercial income at £11 million compares to Manchester United's at 230, and we're not going to go much further up on that scale. The club will do all that they can. And then there's TV income, which is ultimately dependent upon where we finish in the table. So that's outside of our control. So effectively, we are at a ceiling in terms of our ability to generate income unless we start to use players. And I do feel slightly uneasy with this, to use players as commodities that are, as you say, being effectively bought to polish up, effectively rough diamonds, which you polish up and then you sell on at a profit. And whilst on the one side, these are young men, they are individuals, they are the sons and the brothers and the boyfriends and so on of other people. And they must always remember we are dealing with people. From the club's perspective, there is also the opportunity to develop them and to generate a reward on the back of that development. And that can then be reinvested into the playing squad and into the infrastructure of the club on a longer term basis.
I definitely think it perhaps highlights the selfishness that clubs and individuals are perhaps forced into in football nowadays. But I definitely think there's an element of selfishness within probably the significant majority of players, as it is, perhaps quite forced in terms of players know that their careers aren't guaranteed to have any length to them. Everyone does, of course, have to think about themselves. You mentioned the commercial income as well. Is that perhaps what the role of signing someone like Alireza Iheanbash is, even though on the pitch a lot of fans will sort of question his performances. We've seen, I'm sure everyone's seen on social media, footage and photos of Iranian fans, and seen in the Instagram comments of floods of Iranians questioning every starting 11 that doesn't contain Iheanbash. Can that be a signing that's more than perhaps the player?
I don't think so. I think the incremental income we might get from increased social media presence in a country such as Iran, that's worth far less than the difference between finishing 15th and 14th in the Premier League. We're now on around about £2.5 million per place in the table.
Wow.
That is so significant. I would be very surprised if there was ever pressure put on a coach, even if we were safe at the end of a season, to play a particular player because of his background and nationality and appeal back home, for want of a better phrase, simply because that final game of the season could be the difference between finishing 15th and 13th, and that's a £5 million bonus to the club involved, whereas we might be talking tens of thousands of pounds difference if that player scores a goal in that game and everybody goes, well, hey, if you think about it, when Paul Gascoigne went to Italy, we did used to watch Football Italia on Channel 4 back in the 90s, but it didn't actually generate a huge amount of extra money for Lazio.
There you go. That is really fascinating to hear, because I know a lot of people have sort of spoken about, and as fans, we don't genuinely know all the insights, which is why it's fantastic hearing to have someone like you on, as we can sort of provide an insight. And I think I'm learning as much as any of the listeners are right now, in terms of I've always seen that as perhaps that's a really significant signing in terms of extending our global outreach, perhaps in terms of monetary value. But it's really fascinating to hear that perhaps in the grand scheme of things, and it shows just how significant and how big the money is in football, that, as you say, those goals scored, that the finishing positions in the table can be sort of, they can be the decider in terms of a lot of money at stake. So one final question, and we sort of touched on it a little bit in terms of the managers and stuff and their decisions. What are the sort of financial implications of hiring and firing managers? Because, of course, at the end of last season, there was a lot of debate about whether Chris Hughton should have made it to the end of the season. Whereas this season, we've seen Graham Potter have, I believe, a 6-year extended contract very early on in the season. What are the sort of finances surrounding that?
Well, a manager is probably, after I think the owner and the chairman, the third most critical person in terms of the culture of a club. I think the manager or coach, however you want to view them, is therefore somebody that can be worth an absolute fortune to a club. And we see that in the numbers involved. If you get things wrong, then it's not just the cost of sacking the manager. It's the fact that over the course of the previous 12 months, he's likely to have signed 4 or 5 players. Whoever replaces him probably doesn't like 2 or 3 of those players, will want to bring in his own backroom team, and will also be wanting to send out a signal to the fans by bringing in a couple of players he likes as well. So the cost of replacing a manager is extraordinarily high. So if we take a look at Manchester United, to get rid of Mourinho was 19 million pounds. And this was a guy who was deemed to be a failure. If you take a look at Chelsea, when they sacked Conte, that was £26 million. Brendan Rodgers at Liverpool was 16. Everton, just going through a sort of a squad rotation system in terms of their managers, they've spent an absolute fortune on managers, replacing them. And it's very expensive for the club. First of all, to sack the manager. It's also very expensive in terms of the impact it has on recruitment, because it's not just the manager. It's the manager will want his own first team coach. He'll want his own goalkeeping coach. He might want some. He might have some influence on the director of football at the club, when that can lead to conflicts as well. And you might end up with the director of football having to leave. We've seen some complications at West Ham with regards to things of that nature. So recruiting the manager is very expensive, even though the manager, and this is unusual in any types of business, because normally the higher you go up in a business, the more somebody is paid. Whereas if you look at a football club, I would not expect Graham Potter to be necessarily in the top 10 people in terms of salaries at the Albion, simply because we do have some players who will be very well remunerated. Certainly, if you go to Manchester United, the vast majority of the first team squad will be on more than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And that is unique in terms of football as a business.
Is it fair to say, sort of just a concluding point, that in regards to sort of football finances, every sort of little individual element of it sort of exists within sort of a small cog as part of a bigger system? Because what I've sort of gathered from a lot of what you've been saying is all these things interlock with each other. They all influence each other, and they're influenced by the other things as well. And one thing will have knock-on effects that can be significant in terms of money, in terms of time, and just the sheer volume of things that it influences. Is it really that sort of extreme and that sort of broad?
Yes, yeah. I think as fans, you know, we go along, and I'm just as guilty, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I go along to watch the Albion, ideally on a Saturday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, to forget an awful lot about my life, you know, simply because it is that glorious form of escape. And what we do is that we focus upon the 11 players on the pitch and the manager, because he's picked those 11 players. And we have no idea that actually, whilst they are big cogs, there are lots of small cogs in the overall Albion machine which have to work together. And it can be silly things. It can be down to the nature of the tea lady who just cheers the players up every time she sees them. It can be due to the fact that you've got a kit man who knows exactly, what type of, what type of socks, what types of inserts players prefer best in their boots, and things of this nature. And it's building up relationships. You don't work for a company, you don't work for a football club, you work for people. And I think it's absolutely essential in a football club to realise that it is people, and it's those relationships with people that make the club a success or not a success.
And I think that is elegantly summed up in the fact that our club motto has been for years now of being together. And as much as we want to and choose to discuss all these things statistically, financially related, as you say quite well, at the end of the day, it does boil down to your relationships with people. And I think, I think that's definitely summarised by the way the club has acted in terms of when events have occurred, as we're experiencing right now. But as well, when people cast their minds back to other sort of disastrous events, of course, we had the Shoreham air crash not too long ago now. And of course, the way the club responded to that was absolutely fantastic. David Stockdale was immense in terms of the humanised way in which he responded to that and went sort of above and beyond. So I think it's fascinating just to sort of appreciate the way that our club acts sometimes. As you say, with them being one of the biggest clubs in the world, it can be perhaps very easy to be tripped up and sort of get lost in terms of the humanistic approach, as you say, because all of us fans, at the end of the day, what we go there to forget and hopefully to remember some more good things on the pitch from Brighton. But Kieran, thank you very much for your time. That was absolutely fascinating and a fantastic insight into the world of football finance. Have you got anything to say? Anything to say?
No. Well, thanks very much for the invite. I really enjoyed it. I've done about 150 interviews over the course of the last month, and it's really nice to just talk about the Albion for a change.
That is the entire intention of this podcast, is we try not to take ourselves too seriously, but at the same time have a look into a few things that might be of interest and that people might otherwise miss. So absolutely fantastic to have you on. Thank you very much.